time and be educated and entertained by the country's most famous environmental scientist. Joey B has researched grizzly bears, wolves, and birds of prey. He continues to travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Be ready to be amazed. Here's your host, Joey B.
Hello and welcome to Joey B's Outdoor Adventure. Man, do I have the coolest job. I travel all across America to bring you the very best that nature has to offer. Well, this show here, I'm just beaming with excitement because I'm going to get to talk about one of my favorite animals and one of my favorite parts of my research in my lifetime, and that's on wolves. Well, I did some research on wolves in summer movements because we have so much research on winter movements, and I'll get into the reasons for that. But I was out in Minnesota, and now I guess you understand why they're the Minnesota Timberwolves when you look at basketball. And I was up near the Boundary Waters, and one of the more beautiful parts of our country, the night skies, and I remember them vividly. You go out there with a hot cup of tea and lemon, and you're looking at the stars, and really, there's nothing more beautiful. I am an avid fisherman, and when you're in Minnesota, there is water everywhere. The loons are calling at night as you're going to sleep. We were sleeping, you know, our research team was in a log cabin. So it's, I guess, rustic, but doesn't get better than that. And, you know, funny, when we landed, a group of scientists, we meet in the airport and we're getting driven out in a van. And I had never been to the backcountry in Minnesota before. And as we're going out there, and hey, you all know what a stop sign looks like. And, well, these stop signs were much smaller and about 3 feet off the ground. And I'm looking at them as we're driving in the backcountry, and I'm just staring at stop sign, a little bit later stop sign. And I said to the driver, I go, excuse me, are there a lot of clowns around here? And he looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, the stop signs. So, you know, clown cars are real small, clowns get out and all that. He goes, oh, I get it. He goes, they're for snowmobiles. He says, you see, all these roads are closed in the wintertime. Cars can't go through, only snowmobiles. And yes, snowmobiles still have to abide by the laws. But it's just like really cool. It's like, hey, a piece of America that like most people will just never, ever see. It has nothing to do with the research. But guess what? Just a cool little thing. Well, here's the deal about winter movements of wolves versus summer movements of wolves. Wolves are made by body type, and I'm going to get into characteristics in a second, for tracking animals down or running animals down in the winter. Well, you see, if you were to look at, and you know, you see most photos of a wolf and its beautiful long fur, and bear with me for a second here, but if you were to pull all the fur off and you now have what a wolf looks like in the summer with the shorter hair, and you look at him, and he looks like a German Shepherd on stilts, best description, real long legs and these huge paws. But now let's go back to winter movements. Well, the wolves will be running up on top of the crusty snow, as we'll say their prey is a white-tailed deer, who as he's running, his hooves are breaking in, and the wolf is able to run those paws, the size, they're like huge snowshoes going up on top of the snow. Well, if he ever breaks into the snow, those long legs are there to get himself out and up and back on top. So he is made for tracking or chasing down animals in the snow. So as scientists, it's pretty easy to find wolf kills, blood in the snow, etc. It's very easy to find those wolf kills or to track the wolves in the wintertime. Well, summertime movements, think about this. Think about the thickest brush that you've ever been into. And that's what Minnesota was like. I'm going to give you two pieces of the puzzle. That's the first piece of the puzzle. And, well, wolves, they can go easily under the brush. Now you are tracking all day long in brush that is thick as could be. Well, it is just summertime versus wintertime. And I'm going to talk to you, obviously, because my research is about summertime. But I'm going to talk to you all about the summertime movements of wolves. And then some wolf ecology, obviously, we're going to throw in there because that's who I am. And you should know that this show is brought to you by Ramsey Outdoor Stores. Whether you shop online or in one of their stores, your experience will successfully gear you up for your next adventure. Go to RamseyOutdoor.com. So let's set the stage for summer tracking. You know, one wolf in each pack is radio collared. This was already pre-done by the time that we had got there. And there was two teams. There was a tracking team. And in that tracking team, there are three vans. Well, what they simply do then is the vans are in different locations. We would actually set up a specific time. And I'll just say at 10 a.m., they were going to take a reading. And when they would take a reading, they'd have in each van, bang, bang, and bang, longitude, latitude, longitude, latitude, low. And they say, oh, the wolf is here. Well, when they say that, all three lines will then intersect. And the word we use is triangulation. Three vans, triangular, triangulation. And the wolves should be somewhere located where the three lines intersect. Well, I happen to be on the field investigation team, and this is, you know, who I am and what I do. And it was my job or my team's job to go in to see, okay, so what were the wolves doing there in these summer movements? Well, I'm going to let you know that for this research, you need to be super fit. Again, and I'd say this, fitness is a great part of who I am as, you know, growing up as an athlete and then as a scientist and staying out in the field. But this was, every day was a new adventure, and every day actually was physically taxing on the body as well. Well, you've got Minnesota, and Minnesota is called Land of 10,000 Lakes. Well, it is Land of 10,000 Lakes, but it's also Land of 10,000 Lakes, bogs, swamps, marshes, fens, rivers. And I have to throw this in, sorry, Minnesotians. But it should also be called Land of 10,000 Blood-Sucking Mosquitoes, because everywhere we went, if there's that much water, there are that many mosquitoes. You could have played Connect the Dots with the mosquitoes around on my body. It was just amazing. But anyway, and then one of the coolest things that I had ever seen, and we call them, there's, you'll hear about eutrophic lakes, and I'm going to describe this type of eutrophic lake. Well, over thousands of years, some of the plant material, because first thing is you'd have like sphagnum moss and things growing on the edges of it, and then they would continue to grow out and across an actual top of a lake. And then there would be this huge mat of planted material, and sometimes you'd even see smaller understory trees, some birches and things. They'd be popping up there, and well, wolves, they would walk right across this. And now, as a scientist, you know, there are game trails, and game trails are the places that animals have found, and not just one specific animal, but many animals will actually find the easiest way from point A to point B, and over thousands of years, we call them game trails. Well, they're going across there. Well, there were game trails on these eutrophic lakes, and we would actually have to be very careful walking across it. It was I described this as like walking on Jell-O. You wouldn't want to break through, because if you broke through here, getting dead is not a good thing. Well, part of this deal is, everywhere we went, and part of the fitness was we had to portage canoes, because sometimes we'd be tracking wolves on land, and then we'd have to get into water, et cetera. And well, portaging a canoe on land or through a mucky part of, I'll say, a swamp area, a little bit tough. But when you're portaging a canoe on top of a eutrophic lake, and it's like you're walking on Jell-O. And for me, I would always volunteer, because once again, part of my fitness. So one time, I've got a backpack on, my day pack, got the canoe on my head, and portaging in the canoe, and all I'm simply doing is following the scientists in front of me, and wherever they went, obviously I would just look at the feet, because that's all I could see with a canoe on my head, and I would just follow them along. Well, as we're walking along one time, someone in the group stopped, saw something, and everyone stopped, except that where we stopped, there was a yellow jacket nest below me, and the bees are coming up, and they are actually on my back, and I'm getting stung. If they're stung, they are between my, there was an airspace between my backpack and my body, and I'm getting stung over and over and over and over. Well, I can't run, because I'm on a eutrophic lake, breakthrough, getting dead. I can't drop the canoe, breakthrough, getting dead, and I'm just going, help, someone please help me, someone please help me. Well, after a while, I realized, you know, if you remember the old Charlie Brown's mother, where Charlie Brown, his mother would be talking, and all you would be like, wah, 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 wah. Well, I had a canoe on my head, so I'm sure some people are just hearing, wah, 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 and Joey's speaking again, what's he doing? And one of them turns around and goes, oh, look, he's getting stung. So they grab the canoe, take the pack off my back, and I'd say I got stung 40 or 50 times. And it's funny, Joey B, never allergic to bees, but since that time, I have now become very allergic to bees. So Joey B, and it's funny, I've also filmed in, you know, recent adventures with beekeepers, beekeeping suit. I've been out there on Inspector Dave's organic garden. We filmed there in the organic garden. He's got bees in the backyard, bee highway. Not afraid of them. It's just part of nature, part of what you do. But I thought that story should, I guess, be there. Now, with that brush being so thick now, so going from water now onto the brush, you would track the wolves all day long. You didn't worry about getting lost. And you go, well, and I'm telling you, if you put a hand in front of your face, that's how thick the brush was. And yeah, we would get lost, but all we would do at the end of the day is, all right, you say, all right, so it's time, we need to get out of here. You'd pull out your GPS, you'd pull out a topographic map, and I'll talk about topos later on a little bit. And you say, okay, we are here, and we need to get back to the truck, and the truck is at, and then we would begin to work ourselves out of it, because so much of the land, relatively flat there, and it's not like you can get to a mountaintop and look down and go, okay, we need to get to. So this was a little bit more difficult, but again, it's part of it. Wolves, they're very elusive. They are seen only if they choose to be seen. So I share all of that with you so far because, you know, here we are, field investigation team, and I'm telling you, and I'll get into a couple of the other things that are just, you know, really, really cool. But let's talk about, like, you know, another method of identifying, you know, what animals are in a research area. Well, one of the things we use is track pad analysis. And track pad analysis is real simple. You find a game trail and you check the game trails that are traveled often. And you go out there with a rake, and we actually leave a rake because we're in the middle of nowhere. It's not like you need to take it back with you. And you rake out an area so the game trail is now smooth. Sandier area where we were, so it was pretty easy to get some good track. You come back in a, so you're recording date and time, obviously, coming back 24 hours later, and not only will you see what animals are on the game trail, you'll see what animals were walking, were trotting, were loping. So you can get a great indication of what animals are in the area and their movements, which direction they're going in. Well, for those of you that like to, you know, I guess make a couple cool things, this is also the perfect place to make plaster casts. In my backpack, when I go out in the wild, I always have a Ziploc of plaster of Paris, a small little plastic cup. Obviously, I have my water bottle because I'm going to hydrate for myself. And then you just find a little stick. And it's almost making, and I describe it this way, is you put the plaster of Paris plastic cup, you put a little bit of water in, and you stir it. And you know, like when you, I'd say when you're a little kid, but some adults do this, when you keep taking your spoon and your ice cream, and you stir it up, and it's all, like, so to speak, slushy before you eat it, and that little slurry. When your plaster of Paris has that consistency, that's the right one for making tracks. So, you know, we're out there doing research and we want to record what's going on. Well, plaster of Paris is a great way of doing that. And then obviously when you're doing your research, you have some cool, and I'm in my studio right now and I'm looking at one of my wolf tracks that I made out there. It's just spectacular, monster wolf. But that is something that's really, just, I guess, really cool. Also, be careful because when you have a Ziploc of plaster of Paris, and I'm a straight and narrow guy, but it does look like a bag of cocaine. So please be careful. If you get pulled over, please let the police officers know that you happen to have a bag of plaster of Paris in your backpack. Now, when you also are in an area and you want to ID, you know, some of the wolves, well, we're going to ID wolves packs by a couple other things. Some are hair samples that we find, scat, and the kill sites. And, well, you know, scat tells us a lot about an animal because if I know what you're eating, well, then I know where to go find you. And that's a piece of the puzzle. And a great book by, and I'll mention him twice in this show here, is by my professor, Dr. James Halfpenny, and my good friend, Jim Bruschak. These are two of the top educators and trackers in the country, and they have a couple books out, and they are actually called Tracks and Scat. One is in the Northeast and the East and the West, et cetera, because they've broken it down by the different animals you would find in different parts of the country. You can locate them online. Not expensive books, but a great book and a great little field guide that fits in your pack very well. So something to, I guess, to have with you as part of your gear, so to speak. Well, when you're tracking any type of animal, sometimes you find an animal who breaks the rules. Well, there was a wolf that broke the rules of all wolfdom. And, you know, He was wolf number 51. He was what we called a rogue wolf. And notice that I said he was wolf 51 because as scientists, we don't give animals names. We don't say, oh, look, there's Fluffy the wolf. And the reason for that is we don't want any emotional attachments to them. And yes, I know that every documentary you've ever seen or every movie you've ever seen about an animal, and they're talking about a wild animal, and there goes Skippy the wolf going, well, guess what? It's part of, you know, just the, I guess, the flow of a movie or a documentary. But as scientists, they are numbers. Well, with wolf number 51, this rogue wolf, I mean, he was part of a pack. He left the pack. He went and became part of another pack and fathered wolves inside that pack and then decided to leave. And I'm going to tell you right now that one day, rogue wolf 51, he actually swims out to an island on Lake Superior. So the tracking team, they track this wolf triangulation. They're going, what? He's on an island off there. So field investigation team, well, we've got to get out there. So we've got our canoes. And once again, my fitness deal is, okay, I don't mind paddling, taking all the scientists, all the gear, get to the island. And, you know, I had to do this 2 and 3 times. So back and forth. So I paddle with 2, 3 scientists and their gear, get them out, paddle back. And I was paddling back the last time, and I'm not joking. We are on Lake Superior, one of the Great Lakes, and probably in, and it's amazing how deep the water is. And I'll say it was shallow, it was 500 feet deep. It was crazy. And here I am paddling back, and there had not been a breeze all day long. So I'm in the middle of between the shoreline and the island, and all of a sudden a wind gust comes up, and I'm nervous about it, just speaking about it right now. Wind gust comes up out of nowhere and blows my canoe, because I'm sitting in the back, and obviously the front of it's up a little bit, blows it and spins me 360 like a compass, and I spin around, whoo, and like for a second you're startled, and then all of a sudden the winds began to howl. It was crazy, and they were just howling, so going from like 0 miles an hour to I have no idea how many, and I quickly get my body to the center of the canoe, center of gravity, getting it down, cross my legs, and getting my body low, and I begin to paddle back to the shore like that. And I'm telling you, it is, those that know me know, I don't get afraid too often. And this was one of those, okay, let's be afraid deals. But hey, you still have to react and be able to move on the fly and make good decisions. So I get back to the mainland, and I hung out, and all the other scientists, they're on the island, and I get back, I wait, and I'm saying probably in a matter of 15 minutes, the winds were gone again. I made sure in my mind things were safe, load the last bit of gear, get back in the canoe, go back to the island. I never saw a piece of that wind any time before that, nor after that in all of the research. And, so once again, just taking care of yourself and being safe, and actually have a little bit of that. And I'll talk about a little bit about safety and a couple pieces of gear later on. And speaking about getting in those canoes, well, we would paddle all day long going to a place. So you'd paddle, leave the canoe, you'd be tracking wolves, and then you come back to the canoe when research was done, paddle back. Well, one night, and I am not a late night guy because I happen, it's funny. I wake up every morning without the alarm, 4:30, 5 o'clock. My alarm's set for 5 o'clock in the morning, and I'm always downstairs making coffee when the alarm goes off. So one night, I'm in bed, head research scientist. I'm working with Kevin. Kevin comes in, wakes me up, says, Joe, I left the Tremble. Tremble's like a GPS, records different points of that we need and information. Because I left the Tremble outside. And I was like, so here I am. By the way, I don't think you ever want to wake me. It's probably like waking a grizzly bear up. So I'm like, all right, so just go outside and get it. He goes, no, I left it on the rock. I said, go outside and get it. He says, no, I left it on a rock. You know where we had lunch? I go, yeah. He goes, I left it on a rock out there. I said, no. So Kevin and I get up, load a canoe, put it on the Jeep, drive probably about an hour, unload. So it's the middle of the night, so it's pitch black. And by the way, those that also know me know that I never use any foul language at all. So I'm sure I said many words. None of them were foul, but I could probably have made any word sound foul at that point. And I'm going, you sank and bank and sank and bang. And we get in the canoe, some moonlight, so that's a good deal. And we paddle where we need to get. We get the Tremble. We get back in the canoe, we paddle, walk through a little bit of the swampy area, get back in the Jeep, drive, and it's probably close to, I don't know, about 5 in the morning, and without showering, muddy, I didn't care, just climb back in bed, and I get back in bed, and I'm just like dozing off, and another scientist walks in the room and goes, "Hey, Joe, it's your shift, get up." I was like, "Oh, no." So I get up, say a couple harsh words to my good friend Kevin, who's fallen asleep, and then I go out and do it all day long. And again, think about this. You could be miserable, but I'm out tracking wolves. So I may have been tired, but guess what? It still turned out to be the greatest day. Was my tail, because there's wolf tail, was my tail dragging a little bit? Yeah, but guess what? While it's dragging a little bit, it is just one of the cooler things to do out there. I guess you could see, you know, I'm an environmental scientist, so as I'm talking about things like this, I'm still excited. It's funny. While I'm writing up the notes, and I'm a big note taker, while I'm writing up the notes for this show, I am writing down, and I got a smile on my face. Oh, no, I gotta put this. And obviously, I'm putting things in the order that I need to speak about them. And I'm writing down about being tired. I'm going, wow, I'm tired, but that was just still the greatest day in the world. So let's change gears now to pack size and a little bit about the pack dynamics. You know what? The pack size is usually related to a food source. If you have a white-tailed deer versus an elk, and I describe this as a nice meal versus a five-course dinner because elk happen to be huge. I always talk about elks as being horses on steroids. No, they're not, but they're just monstrous animals. So obviously you would have a larger pack in that area because the food source can support them. And, you know, with pack dynamics, you have alpha male and female. And, you know, it's not only their rights to mate, it's their rights to feed first, getting the prime sources of food. And, well, if they're going to be the child-rearing animal, so to speak. And so there you have that piece of pack dynamics. And some of the times, we would have to go out and locate a pack. And, well, these pack dynamics, one night we're out and, you know, people will do howling studies. Well, we'll just go out and howl. And the wolves will howl back in response to another single rogue wolf inside their territory or many wolves. And they're going to let people know, excuse me, I live here. This is my area. And they're going to howl back. One night, we're out. We go to locate a pack. And all of a sudden, we hear a juvenile just by himself howling. And we realize, wait, juvenile, where's the rest of the pack? Because, I mean, some territory sizes are monstrously miles upon miles upon miles large. And then all of a sudden, you start to hear a little pup. You ever hear like a little puppy around the house and they can't bark yet and they're yelping, so to speak. And then, well, we hear the juvenile and we hear the pup. And what had happened is the pack was off hunting and you know how you will hire a babysitter? Well, they had the juvenile who was babysitting the pup. And we didn't want to put any stress on the juvenile and the pup because they howled back and they did. And then all of a sudden they were just dead silent. And they were dead silent because the juvenile was smart enough to take the pup elsewhere. And we stopped as well. But it shows you a little bit about, like you talk about pack dynamics. And, you know, you always hear about male, you know, the alpha male and female. Well, now let's talk about juveniles and their pups. And that was a pretty neat deal. And, you know, as you're tracking and you're locating, you need to be careful when you come across, you know, wolf kill sites. Because wolf kill sites, obviously, this is their food. So you need to be careful when you're entering those. And a lot of times, you know, you can get to a kill site when there's nothing left but bones. And most times, the wolves will actually, in the last part of what they chew, and you could actually find a lot of calcium in their scat. And the calcium in their scat is because they're chewing up the bones. Well, in that pack dynamics, we had located a birthing den, and obviously, think about this, and this makes sense. They gave birth in one den, and then because of the smell of the afterbirth, etc., they would actually pick up the pups and move them elsewhere to another den, the nursing den. Well, think about how cool this is. You're talking about this wolf with these huge canine teeth and how ferocious and how many pounds of pressure they have when they bite down on something, all this hamstring animal, blah, blah, all that. And then they're delicate enough to actually pick up a pup, and I'm doing this in the nice calm voice, and they pick up a pup and their mouth, and they can carry them and without ever breaking skin and bring them then to the nursery den. And outside the nursery den, we found a few pup toys. And you think about if you ever, you know, you went out in, you know, the woods with your, down in the backyard with your dog, and you got a stick, and you throw the stick, and dog brings it back. Well, after a while, you got a couple little teeth marks inside, you know, on the stick from your larger dog. Well, we would find these little sticks, this tiny little, we'll call them twigs, and you'd have all the little tooth marks inside of it from the puppies, and the puppies were playing, and these were pup toys. It was really, really, again, you know, you always hear about the pack dynamics, and they're always talking about the monstrous, we got a pack of five here and a pack of nine, and et cetera. Well, now I'm telling you about some of the, I guess, the inner workings of that pack dynamics. So let me change gears for a minute and talk about the necessary gear you need when you're out tracking. And hey, it could be any animal. Well, before I spoke about hydration and energy, and I don't go anywhere without food and water because I want to eat all the time. Life is good when you eat, man. My saying always is, if you cook well, you eat well. Hey, so, but now let's change gears. And I'll say the necessary gear is you need great footwear. And that means boots as well as socks and sock liners. And it depends on the time of the year, what type of socks you're going to be using. And I'm telling you, clean socks, great hiking boots. And a lot of people use low cuts, and that is not for me. The ankle twisting world of rocks and bogs and all those different things. Well, I am a mid cut to, you know, mountaineering. If I'm up in the top of the Rockies, and I'll talk to you other shows about some other research I've done in mountaineering boots, much higher boots up there. And also depends on the time of the year, but we always talk about wicking layers, getting moisture away from your body, because this is how you stay warm. I actually do a show on prepping your gear and your body for outdoors. So that's something you might want to check that show on. I know we've already recorded it and released it, so it's out there. So for you to listen. And I'd say two things now is having a first aid kit with you and knowing first aid, because it's like, I've got a toolbox and I've got all the tools. Well, how do you use them? Well, I don't know. Well, it's the same thing with first aid in your local Red Cross. I would take, even if it's just, but they do have outdoor first aid courses, and that's something that you should also think about using or knowing. And then the other thing is having a compass. And some people, well, I got a compass. Why do you use it? Well, I don't know. Well, guess what? Taking a map and compass course is also important. And probably your local Ramsey Outdoor or your local outdoor store somewhere, they will actually have courses on map and compass and learning how to read that topographic map. And when I'm in larger areas, because I explained to you what the brush is like here, when I'm in larger areas, I can actually look at a topo and see that mountain and say, okay, well, the mountain's here. And I could figure out, even without the compass, say, I am here. And I guess that comes through like anything. My buddy Coach Gorski says, what you get reps at is what you get good at. And he's talking about football, but he's also talking about life. And if I get any reps at, you know, being out and using topographic maps, well, then I'm going to get better at it. And they also offer tracking classes if you're out there doing research on animals. And once again, and I don't get any money from these guys. They just happen to be the best at what they do. And I mentioned Dr. Halfpenny before, and Dr. James Halfpenny has his education center in, I guess it's it's Gardner, Montana, right outside of Yellowstone, and he offers some of the greatest tracking classes because, once again, he's one of the best trackers and scholars of animals in the world. And then in the east, you can find Jim Bruschak at the Indochina Wilderness Center, and Jim, good friend of mine, and Jim is also this great tracker as well. So if you're looking for tracking classes, I would say those. And then in my necessary gear for the outdoors, I listed a good bed. And it's funny that I'll describe it this way because you guys know, and this is just me. You get away from home court, like where you know, your home. Your bedding isn't always perfect, and sometimes your bedding just because it doesn't feel like home. So I'm going to say a good night's sleep to recharge your battery is really important. Now, I spoke to you about all these wolves in Minnesota, so let me tell you about one of the cooler experiences that I had in life. Well, I was out in Montana, and in this, I was doing research on grizzly bears. Hey, a topic for another show. And I was out there doing research on grizzly bears. When I was done, this is a few years back now, and I attended the conference in Bozeman, Montana, and they were talking about the reintroduction of wolves. See, I'm excited again. Reintroduction of wolves into Yellowstone. And I'm at this conference, and they gave every American, whoever wanted to be there, you had 3 minutes to go up to a microphone, and you can say why you wanted the wolves or did not want the wolves reintroduced into Yellowstone. And they allowed a Native American to go up there first, And he was the only one because there was no specific order after that. A Native American, he actually had written a song. Remember, he only had 3 minutes. But he spoke about or sang about a song that dealt with what the wolf meant to the Native American culture. One of the cooler experiences. And then you had, you know, nature lovers that would get up there and say, hey, you know, I am here to talk about the wolves and the beauty, et cetera. And you get ranchers and you get both sides. And it was so cool to listen because some ranchers would say, hey, a wolf comes on my property, I'm going to shoot and kill him. Well, that was going to be illegal. But they were honest enough to say that. And then you get some ranchers who would step up and say, hey, I've got so many problems going on that a wolf on my property would be the least of my problems. But I got to hear all of that. And then obviously after that point, they did reintroduce the wolves in Yellowstone. And another research project that I had done, spent many summers actually out in Idaho. I was actually doing non-native plant species on the sagebrush steppe. Long-winded research. Hey, maybe that's a topic for another show. But anyway, when I was done or, you know, taking a break from my research, I was only an hour and a half from Yellowstone and I would zip into, I love to fly fish, and I would zip into Yellowstone and I'd fly fish. And anytime my research projects were done near Yellowstone grizzly bear or the non-native plant species, I'd meet family and friends out in Yellowstone. And I'd been there. I actually called it my summer playground because I was just like always there. And I would just guide them through Yellowstone. And we'd fly fish our way through. But one of the cool things now is, as the wolves were reintroduced and their pack size and pack dynamics began to, you know, happen, and, you know, I'd go into the Lamar Valley, you'd see the wolves. And once again, I'm that guy who's waking up before first light, and I'd just get up before everyone, and I'd be into Yellowstone, and I would just be listening to wolves howl. And, you know, take my cup of coffee with me. I'm out there. I'm listening. And I'd come back and people would be waking up like 8, 9 o'clock going, ah, what are we going to do today? I was like, well, I already listened. Oh, you didn't. Why didn't you wake me up? Because you wouldn't get up. But there are those things. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm not a night guy, but if you said, hey, we're going owling tonight, we got to count owls. Well, guess what? I'm going to hike all night long. So maybe those of you that are not morning people, there are some great morning things to listen to. And I'm going to tell you right now, wolves. And wolves howling is one of them. So you've got the mystique about the wolves, the beauty about the wolves. Well, I'm going to tell you that wolves give us all that nature has to offer. And I'm sure you could hear in my voice, you know, as I'm actually getting close to the end of the show, you could hear in my voice that there is just this, this energy because wolves, I guess we all get excited about something in life. And wolves get me excited about, like, this is what nature is all about. When you want to learn about the ecology of an animal, they're there. You want to see the beauty of an animal, it's there. And then you get out and you're seeing, well, guess what? I'm in the middle of nowhere, USA. And it has everything that I've been looking for. Life does not get any better. You can follow all of my adventures online at joeybee.tv. That's joeybee.tv. And a very special thank you to the men and women of our armed forces for keeping us free and for our police and firefighters for keeping us safe. May God bless America. Until next time, this is Joey B. Enjoy life's adventures. Joey B's adventure. Joey B's adventure. Joey B. Joey B's adventure. Joey B's adventure. That was awesome.